and welcome to Discussions with DPIC. I'm Robert Dunham, the Executive Director of the Death Penalty Information Center. In this episode, we'll be speaking with Christina Swarns about the case of Dwayne Buck, the concept of future dangerousness, and racial bias. Dwayne Buck was sentenced to death in 1997 in a trial tainted by racially biased testimony on the likelihood that he posed a future danger to society. In February 2017, the United States Supreme Court overturned Buck's death sentence. Christina Swarns is the Director of Litigation at the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund and argued Buck versus Davis before the United States Supreme Court in October 2016. She's also a member of DPIC's Board of Directors. Christina, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Let's begin with Dwayne Buck's trial more than 20 years ago. What happened in that trial that ultimately brought us to the Supreme Court last year?
Sure. So Dwayne was arrested and charged with capital murder for the shooting of his girlfriend and a gentleman that was in the girlfriend's apartment. He was arrested at the scene. So once he was appointed counsel, which he received court-appointed counsel because he was an indigent person, he did not have the funds and the resources to retain private counsel. But once he was appointed counsel, it was clear that the question, the pivotal question, was not going to be about guilt or innocence, but instead it was going to be about whether or not Mr. Buck was going to be sentenced to death or to life imprisonment. In preparation for the sentencing phase of the trial, the court-appointed attorneys retained an expert to evaluate Mr. Buck and to make an assessment of his likelihood of committing future criminal acts of violence. In Texas, this finding of whether a person is likely to commit criminal acts of violence in the future is a prerequisite for a death penalty. And so if the jury doesn't find the future dangerousness, the so-called future dangerousness factor, the person on trial cannot be sentenced to death. So they had this expert named Walter Quijano evaluate Mr. Buck and make an assessment of his likely future dangerousness. Before the trial started, the expert provided counsel with a written report, and that written report found and wrote explicitly that the expert believed that one of the factors that made Mr. Buck more likely to be dangerous in the future was the fact that he is black. And it literally just says that in the report, you know, these are the factors I considered: race, black, you know, increased likelihood of future dangerousness, period. Now, once they received that report, counsel had a lot of options available to them. They could have gotten rid of the expert. They could have told the expert what was obvious, which is that that is unconstitutional. You cannot consider race as a factor in favor of a death sentence, so you have to take it out and reevaluate it. They could have redacted the report. They could have done a whole bunch of things, but they did nothing. Instead, they just put the expert on the witness stand and elicited this exact testimony during the penalty phase of Mr. Buck's trial. Not surprisingly, the prosecutor was delighted to hear this testimony and had the expert reiterate it on cross-examination, and then the prosecutor argued in closing that the jury could rely on the expert testimony to find Mr. Buck was a future danger and should be, and was therefore eligible and should be sentenced to death. So that is a short version, a condensed version of what happened at trial.
Well, Christina, I mean, that's astonishing. Why would a lawyer ever put on a doctor to testify that his own client posed a greater risk to society because of his race?
It is the $100,000 question, and we really have no idea. I mean, really, it is astonishing. You're absolutely right. I mean, it's astonishing that they knew about this before trial and did it anyway. It's astonishing that the judge sat in this courtroom and let this testimony be put on and didn't say a word. It's astonishing that the district attorney, you know, who was a member of the bar and also knew that this was unconstitutional, instead of, you know, either avoiding or ignoring it, instead sort of doubled down on it and utilized it, and, you know, in her own way. This was a complete failure, literally, of all aspects of the criminal justice system.
And Dwayne Buck wasn't the first time that the Dr. Quijano had given testimony like this.
No, not at all.
So what else was out there?
We know he testified in several other cases. It looked like Dr. Quijada at the time, this is 1997, had a little bit of a cottage industry of testifying in capital cases. Sometimes he testified as a defense witness, as he did in Mr. Buck's case, and sometimes he testified as a prosecution witness. But invariably, when he testified, if he was evaluating a person who was black or Latino, then he used the fact of their race or ethnicity as a factor that increased their likelihood of committing future acts of violence.
And even before Dwayne Buck's trial, hadn't he testified in other cases exactly that way?
Several other cases, at least five other cases, but I think they're actually, that I know of right now, I could say that he testified in at least five to seven other cases like this. He presented this kind of testimony.
Yeah, and we talked earlier about how it was astonishing that his lawyer would ever present a witness to testify this way. It makes you wonder even more when you know that there's this obligation on the part of counsel to be aware of what his own expert has said in the past.
Absolutely, right? This was totally knowable, and in fact, counsel did know it, right? You have to remember, he had this report before the trial started, before there was a jury in the box. He knew that this was what counsel, what the expert was going to testify to. There really is, as the Supreme Court ultimately found, no strategic reason. There was no way that evidence could have benefited Mr. Buck, and particularly under the facts of Mr. Buck's case, where there really wasn't a lot of evidence of future dangerousness. This was not a person who had any criminal convictions, any violent criminal convictions, and that is the primary factor that the government uses in Texas to prove future dangerousness, right? You would say you have a history of dangerous convictions, and you're probably likely to continue to, you know, have more dangerous convictions in the future, violent convictions in the future. But Mr. Buck didn't have any violent felony convictions. And so it was going to be a challenge for the state to prove the future dangerousness factor. So it is doubly ineffective and confusing and absurd that the defense counsel would introduce evidence that sort of filled the gap in the state's evidence here. So it really is just astonishing what happened here.
And with a constitutional violation that's this obvious, how is it that the case had to go all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court?
Oh, that's a question we've asked ourselves 100 times. But the short answer is that, you know, Mr. Buck, you know, couldn't win for losing. So not only did he have these particular attorneys at trial, one of whom, Adam Liptek at the New York Times, subsequently wrote an article about, and he observed that this particular lawyer had put more people on death row than had several states. So he really, really, Mr. Buck drew the short straw at the trial counsel stage, but then he also drew the short straw at the direct appeal and state post-conviction stage, because even though the fact that this evidence was introduced at trial, the fact that trial counsel had this report before trial, all of this was in the record, right? This didn't require any, you know, extra evidentiary investigation or anything like that. This was all just on the sort of cold page of the record. Neither direct appeal counsel nor state habeas counsel raised a substantive challenge to the introduction of this evidence or a Sixth Amendment challenge to trial counsel's ineffectiveness for relying on this evidence. So, unfortunately, what happened was, per the, you know, rules, the state and federal rules, the challenge to the constitutionality of Mr. Buck's death sentence based on this evidence was found to be procedurally defaulted, which means that, you know, it became very difficult and ultimately until 2013, impossible to get relief on it.
Now, before we talk about what happened in 2013, I think that's a point that's really important for our listeners. Most people think that if you go challenge your death sentence in federal court and you find a very serious constitutional violation, the court's automatically going to review it, and if you have an unconstitutional death sentence, that's going to be overturned. But what you're saying here is that because he had bad lawyers in state court, the federal court wasn't even going to look at it.
That's right. The federal court's hands were completely tied. The law is that if you, your attorneys, do not raise your constitutional claims of constitutional violations at the first opportunities, whether on direct appeal to the state Supreme Court or in collateral appeals in the state courts, once the case gets to federal court, that claim is not reviewable by a federal judge. So you cannot win on a claim that has not been reviewed by the state courts. And if your lawyers don't present it, then it's not going to be reviewed.
So even with as blatant a constitutional violation and as horrible testimony as saying somebody is more likely to be dangerous because they're black, Dwayne Buck would have been executed.
Absolutely. There is absolutely no question that he would have been executed had intervening events not happened in this case. And that was literally terrifying for us because it says, you know, I mean, it really underscores sort of the potential, the actual injustice that is allowed by these procedural default rules.
So what happened in 2013?
So in 2013, the United States Supreme Court changed the rules. Prior to 2013, as we discussed, the rule was if your state appellate lawyers did not present a challenge to trial counsel's performance at trial at the first opportunity, then the federal courts couldn't decide whether or not trial counsel was or was not effective at trial. And that was the law for years and years and years prior to 2013. In 2013, the Supreme Court, however, decided to reconsider that rule. The court concluded that because the absence of effective counsel at trial really undermined the Sixth Amendment and really undermined the foundations upon which our criminal justice system stands, right? A fair prosecutor, a fair defense attorney, a fair jury. If you don't have one of those three legs of the stool, you don't really have a fair trial. Because the Supreme Court recognized how important that assessment is, it concluded that under certain limited circumstances, the federal courts can review a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel, even if it was not timely presented to the state courts. Specifically, the Supreme Court said if you have a substantial claim, like a really good claim of ineffective assistance of counsel, the federal courts can look at it and decide that it is important enough to review and make a decision on. And so once that decision came down, we really thought we had an opportunity to secure justice for Mr. Buck, because that was exactly the circumstances that were presented by his case.
So you raised that to the courts, and then what happened?
So we went into the federal district court in the Southern District of Texas being pretty confident. We had what we thought was a clear-as-day claim that Mr. Buck did not receive fair and constitutionally appropriate counsel at trial because no competent lawyer would present racially biased evidence against his own client. And we knew it was deeply prejudicial because, like I said, the prosecution didn't have really a lot of evidence of future dangerousness. And so we went into federal court and we said, hey, you know, let's go back. We have this new decision. We should look at Mr. Buck's case. He deserves a new sentencing hearing because he never had fair counsel at his first sentencing hearing. And much to our surprise and our dismay, the district court denied our motion. Not only did she deny it, she characterized the claim as unremarkable. And she said there was just no merit, no basis upon which she should grant, consideration to us for this, to Mr. Buck for this claim. And frankly, we were floored.
Did she say that it was not bad performance by counsel?
What she said was it was bad performance. She said it was deficient performance in the language of the Supreme Court decision, but it wasn't prejudicial. Ultimately, she said that in the context of this case, even though counsel should have probably not introduced that evidence, given the facts and circumstances of this, the crime and the trial, it wasn't so bad.
And that's, you know, to me, that's also remarkable, especially given the what I think will be classic language from Chief Justice Roberts in his opinion. You know, Texas argued that there wasn't a lot of transcript space taken up mm-hmm. by by the comments about race and future dangerousness. I think it will be a classic line that some toxins can be deadly in small doses.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And that was the position we had taken the whole way through, that once you introduce the race as dangerousness link is so pernicious and so ingrained in history and culture and, you know, and the death penalty in this country, that the introduction, the explicit introduction of that evidence by an expert, by a defense expert, can only be deeply prejudicial. There's no way, no matter how many lines of transcript space it occupies, that it was not profoundly prejudicial.
This is a 400-year stereotype, right?
Exactly.
The classic discriminatory view and bigoted view that if you're a black male, you're dangerous.
That's exactly right. And that is something that the Supreme Court had previously recognized in Turner versus Murray, right? The Supreme Court said that, you know, a jury, you know, exposed to a particularly heinous crime and an African-American offender, you know, that kind of can be triggered. The race as dangerousness stereotype can be triggered, you know, just by, right, terrible facts. Here we had terrible facts. Plus, you have an expert, you know, saying out loud and validating with sort of the imprimatur of, you know, a PhD, what would otherwise traditionally be, you know, implicit or you know, maybe thought but not said. Here you had somebody not only saying it out loud, but giving an expert, defense expert, you know, validation to this idea. And so it was literally, you know, straight out of history and sort of straight out of nightmares. It was really unbelievable.
You know, and it's been an issue for a long time in Texas, the whole question about whether assessments of future dangerousness are reliable at all. And there have been a number of controversial doctors. Can you talk a little bit about that and how race and racial stereotyping comes into or gets picked up by this kind of junk science diagnoses that we've seen in the courts?
Yeah, I mean, right. As you noted, right, we have had several over, you know, in the history, several doctors who have, you know, come in declaring themselves experts in the business of predicting who is and who is not going to commit terrible crimes in the future, right? Dr. Death, you know, these experts in the prediction of human behavior and sort of human, you know, pathology with respect to violence have sort of gained prominence over history in Texas. Time and again, these predictions have been proven false. I mean, I think Dwayne Buck is really a powerful example of how absurd these kind of predictions are, because here we have, you know, putting aside, which is a big aside, right, the racist aspect of the prediction here of future dangerousness, we now know that any prediction of future dangerousness for Mr. Buck in particular was false, because he has now been in prison, you know, since 1997, and he has a perfect disciplinary record. Not only did, you know, there's no crime of violence, we aren't even close to that. You know, he's had no disciplinary infractions of any kind. This is the most unlikely to commit a crime of violence, well-adjusted to the prison setting human being you could imagine. So the predicting, this business of predicting future human behavior, you know, is absurd, and it's completely junk science. You know, as I've said before, I have a 9-year-old daughter, but listen, I wish I could guess what she was going to do tomorrow, but I certainly cannot.
You know, in Texas and a couple of other states, you have to overtly find future dangerousness to be eligible for the death penalty, and you told us about that a little bit earlier.
Right.
But there are other places across the country where juries are making that kind of assessment all the time without it being part of the required evaluation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How do you think, especially with the stereotyping that we've seen in prosecutorial arguments and in testimony by these expert witnesses, how do juries deal with that, and what kind of racial impact is there?
You know, I mean, I think the typical way is that it's sort of an unspoken, unsaid, you know, belief, right? As it's just as you know, we talked about a few minutes ago, you know, this is an archetype. This is a perception. There's a perceived link between race and criminality, that has existed throughout the history of our country. Obviously, the recent publicity around police killings of black men throughout the country is a powerful example of that. But what happens, I think, in the jury box is that, you know, if you have an African-American man on trial for his life, and there, you know, is a terrible crime, right, there is just an unspoken belief that that person is going to be dangerous in the future, and therefore the death penalty is more appropriate. Whereas if you have a white person who is also on trial for, you know, facing the death penalty, you know, you can, I think you, a jury is more likely to be receptive to evidence of mitigation, right, evidence about life history, evidence that would undercut a death sentence than they are in cases involving African-American defendants. And we know that because we've had extraordinary social scientists like Jennifer Eberhardt out of Stanford do, you know, comprehensive, you know, fully validated studies looking at and comparing the rate at which African-Americans and similarly situated white defendants have fared in front of juries. And Dr. Eberhardt ultimately concluded in a very famous Philadelphia study that the more black a defendant looked, the more likely they were to be condemned to death. And that is a story that is replicated. It's not, you know, it's not typical just to Philadelphia. It is typical to every single death row in this country.
And the stunning thing about Jennifer Eberhardt's study is it's not just that that you're more likely to get the death sentence if you are black, but it's what you look like and who the victim is.
Right, right. I mean, it's fascinating, really. It's a fascinating study, right? There's a continuum of how black you look, right? Like a continuum of blackness, right? And then that is exacerbated by the race of victim, right? With the white victim, it just increases the likelihood of being condemned to death the more black you appear. It's really an extraordinary finding.
Twice as likely. It's unbelievable.
It is.
Let's try to move this to a different context. Race and the death penalty are inextricably linked.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that when white people look at the issue, they see one thing. When black people look at the issue, they see something very different. Just a couple weeks ago in Arkansas, we had 8 executions scheduled in the course of 11 days. And there were 4 stays of execution that were upheld, that survived, and there were 4 defendants who were executed. Three of the 4 stays were white defendants, and 3 of the 4 executions were black defendants.
You know, this is a story as old as the death penalty itself. You know, that disproportionality, there has never been a time in the administration of the death penalty, there's never been a place in the administration of the death penalty where there isn't a race effect, period, hard stop. You know, whether it is the rate at which African-Americans are condemned to death, the rate at which prosecutors seek the death penalty for black versus white offenders, the rate at which whether the prosecutors seek the death penalty for white victims or black victims, whether, you know, jury sentence offenders to death relatively looking at white victims or black victims, there is, without exception, always a skew against African Americans in the death penalty process. You know, there was a study by the General Accounting Office in the federal government who reviewed all of the research on this and found there's a consistently a race effect in the administration of the death penalty. It's just indisputable, and it has never been ameliorated, right? We had the death penalty struck down in 1972 based on the conclusion that it was arbitrarily administered, and it was reinstated in 1976 under the theory that we could create statutes that eliminated arbitrary factors like race, right? If we could control the factors that the jury would consider in making its death sentencing or life sentencing decisions, then it would be constitutional. And if we make sure that race is not on the list of factors that juries will consider, then we can eliminate the influence of racial bias from the administration of the death penalty. That was the hypothesis that the Supreme Court adopted in 1976 in Gregg versus Georgia when they reinstated the death penalty. That hypothesis has been repeatedly and consistently proven to be false, right? You can control for whatever the statutes can be explicit as they want to about what factors the jury can properly consider, but ultimately race is playing out even in these so-called guided discretion statutes, because ultimately we are still seeing race of victim effect, and in many jurisdictions we are seeing race of defendant effect. And what happened in Arkansas is a perfect example of even with these the supposed controls in place, you still see a race effect.
So what do we do about this?
Such a hard question. I think at the end of the day, for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, the answer has always been the same, which is that the death penalty cannot be administered fairly and without regard to race, because as long as human beings in this country are, have racial bias, which we do, that is going to continue to play an unfair and an unfairly dispositive role and who lives and who dies. And so for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, organizationally, and for me personally, it is that we should therefore end, we should stop tinkering with the machinery of death. We should abolish the death penalty.
Well, that gets me up to pretty much our last question, because I am going to ask you to tinker with the machinery of death for a second. That is, in Buck, future dangerousness pervaded the decision. But the court did not actually address future dangerousness as a legal issue.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any kind of systemic remedy that a court could come up with to make future dangerousness a more principled concept on which to rely, or to eliminate the arbitrariness and the bias in juries making determinations of future dangerousness?
That's a big question. I think, when you look at there's obviously now a big burgeoning field of risk assessment, predictions and tools for a variety of reasons, bail and all the other contexts in the criminal justice system where risk assessment comes up. And what you find, I think, time and again, is that these risk assessment tools rely on, as in the future dangerousness context, it relies on, in many instances, sort of criminal history. And, built into criminal history is sort of the biases upon which the criminal justice system operates. And that includes sort of racial profiling, the fact that police make decisions in all jurisdictions, which they disproportionately police communities of color, which yields, disproportionate criminal court involvement by people of color. So it's very hard to not incorporate sort of the racial biases that exist in our country into risk assessment instruments in such a way that you could say that you have now controlled out racial bias. And so I just don't have a way that I know of, and I'm certainly not a statistician, where you can have a jury finding about what this kind of prediction of dangerousness that would eliminate racial bias, that would neutralize the effect of racial bias.
This is fascinating stuff.
It is. It really is.
Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for this month's podcast. Christina, I'd like to thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you, Rob. It's been a pleasure.
To learn more about Buck v. Davis and other death penalty issues, visit deathpenaltyinfo.org. And to make sure you don't miss an episode of Discussions with DPIC, please subscribe on your podcast app of choice.